now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, and our producer this morning. The war in Ukraine entering its second month. Over 3.5 million people have fled the country of Ukraine. The majority have gone to Poland, 2.2 million. President Biden is in Poland. He will be making a speech today. It's being billed as a major speech. He will visit with Ukraine refugees. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, is with the president. Here's how he describes what the president will say today.
And he will give a major address tomorrow that will speak to the stakes of this moment, the urgency of the challenge that lies ahead, what the conflict in Ukraine means for the world, and why it is so important that the free world sustain unity and resolve in the face of Russian aggression. He'll also talk about the context and history of this conflict and where he sees it going from here.
President Zelensky is claiming this morning that 16,000 Russian troops have been killed. Russian generals are now saying that the Donbas region in the east was the actual goal of the campaign. That's a shift in the approach from the Russians. Ukraine this morning is saying that Russian troops have been routed from a village east of Kyiv. President Biden, as I mentioned, will be speaking today with that major speech. He spoke a couple of times this week in news conferences. One of the dust-ups that occurred, there were a couple of gaffes the president made, and one of them was over deterrent and deter. And we'll set this up for you, because what happened is the press conference, as you know, the president typically will have cards that identify who he is supposed to call on. Well, he went through the list and he started to walk off, and then he came back and he took another question. It was a reporter from CBS. Now, I want to just remind you of how the president and the entire administration were talking about the role of sanctions as deterrents to Putin going to war. Remember when they said, if we impose the sanctions, it will deter Putin from going to war? If you don't remember, here's what they said.
Yes, our intention is to have a deterrent effect.
The president believes that sanctions are intended to deter.
The purpose of the sanctions, in the first instance, is to try to deter Russia from going to war.
We want them to have a deterrent effect, clearly, and he hasn't invaded yet.
The allied relationship is such that we have agreed that the deterrence effect of these sanctions is still a meaningful one.
So that was the plan. That would deter the war. So the president takes a question that he wasn't sure even who the reporter was. Here, how it went.
Who are you?
I'm Christina Arcady from CBS. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Sir, deterrence didn't work. What makes you think Vladimir Putin will alter course based on the action you've taken today?
Let's get something straight. You remember, if you covered me from the very beginning, I did not say that, in fact, the sanctions would deter him. Sanctions never deter. You keep talking about that. Sanctions never deter. The maintenance of sanctions, the increasing the pain, and the demonstration why I asked for this NATO meeting today is to be sure that after a month we will sustain what we're doing, not just next month, the following month, but for the remainder of this entire year. That's what will stop him.
You believe the action today will have an impact on making Russia change course in Ukraine?
That's not what I said. You're playing a game with me. I know. The answer is no. I think what happens is we have to demonstrate the purpose. The single most important thing is for us to stay unified.
So anyway, that was the back and forth. Boy, he scolded her for reminding him of what his administration had been saying in the run-up to the war. Whatever. So that was one of the dust-ups with the media. Now, there was a gaffe that you may have heard about, and a couple of gaffes this week, but here's the first one. And the only reason I bring these up is because they're pretty significant gaffes in what he says. This is just not like a little slip of the tongue. This is an ABC reporter asking him about the response to possible chemical weapons. Listen to what the president says about our response.
Sir, you've made it very clear in this conflict that you do not want to see World War III. But is it possible that in expressing that so early that you were too quick to rule out direct military intervention in this war? Could Putin have been emboldened knowing that you are not going to get involved directly in this conflict?
No and no.
I do not believe that. And to clarify on chemical weapons, could, if chemical weapons were used in Ukraine, would that trigger a military response from NATO?
It would trigger a response in kind. Whether or not you're asking whether NATO would cross, we'd make that decision at the time.
So when you say response in kind, what that means is we would respond with chemical weapons, which would be obviously illegal. And my understanding is we don't even have chemical weapons. Again, not picking on him, but that's a pretty significant gaffe if you're threatening to use chemical weapons against Russia. The other gaffe that was made that's gotten a lot of attention, and again, it's a significant one, and that's when the president was speaking with troops yesterday in Poland, our U.S. troops he was visiting. And you'll hear him say that when you're in Ukraine, and you'll also hear him say that you'll see the women in front of Russian tanks. So that implies that our troops would be going in while the Russians were still there, not later, but while there are still Russian troops there. Listen to it, and you'll see what caused the commotion.
The average citizen, look at how they're stepping up. Look at how they're stepping up. And you're going to see when you're there, and some of you have been there, you're going to see women, young people standing in the middle in front of a damn tank, just saying, I'm not leaving. I'm holding my ground.
That's what he said, and obviously people are going, well, are the troops going in? That was the 82nd Airborne, and again, I kind of mention this because of the significance that the United States and the administration have been so careful about saying anything that would possibly upset Vladimir Putin, because we don't want him to take it to the next step. So we have been tippy-toeing around President Putin, but then Biden says two things that if I were Putin, say, wait a minute, he's going to come at us with chemical weapons, and oh, he's sending the troops in. So I guess when the president goes off script, it can be a little bit dangerous. It is 6:16. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. And coming up on the program today, we will have our experts joining us, and we'll be looking at the major stories of the weekend and of the past week. We'll talk with John Gizzi, the White House reporter at Newsmax. We'll get his read on the president's visit to the NATO summit and to Poland. Also, Liz Cheney is facing some pretty stiff competition from her own Republicans in the Wyoming primary. 100 of them are going to get together here in Washington later in the week. We'll tell you about that. President Trump has withdrawn his endorsement for Mo Brooks in the Alabama Senate race. How come? Well, John's got the story. Also, we'll be talking about the controversies surrounding Ginni Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice, of course. We'll try and put that in perspective because the mainstream media has taken that a bit out of context. And also his read on the next steps in the confirmation process of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson for the Supreme Court. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. Did they accomplish anything in Brussels or not? We will ask him. And also the whole question of sanctions and deterrence. We'll talk with Tony Schaefer about that. Cheryl Atkinson will join us, and she's got an exclusive on the origins of the Omicron virus. And she's got some very interesting information coming up for us. Also the latest on COVID research that's being conducted at Fort Detrick. And the controversy over television cameras in the courtroom. That could go as high as the Supreme Court. That's all coming up with Cheryl this morning. Jennifer Harper joins us. We'll get a look at Americans' attitude on the gas price crisis and the economy overall. President Trump will be at a rally in Georgia later today. She'll have the rundown for us. And some surprising Trump versus Biden poll numbers. You'll definitely want to hear about that. KT McFarland will put everything in perspective for us later on this morning. So she takes a look at the foreign policy implications, what's been happening at NATO this week, and the president on the world stage. So it's all coming up on the Saturday morning update, and we're going to head over to the WMAL Traffic Center and also check WMAL weather this morning.
Still some accident cleanup activity taking place in Camp Springs on the outer loop of the Beltway after Branch Avenue. It is confined to the left shoulder. Just a very brief delay there. No other problems to report on the Beltway at this time. Looks like the road work on the inner loop and outer loop ramps to 66 have been cleared for now. Right now, if you are traveling in the Bethesda area, keep in mind that a portion of Bradley Boulevard is still closed with emergency cleanup work between Rayburn Road and Bradmore Drive. Also, watch out for construction southbound on the Rockville Pike between Woodmont Avenue and Stanford Street, and that is affecting the right lane. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Definitely a cool weekend headed your way with a fair amount of cloud cover as well. Temperatures today only in the low to mid-50s with mostly cloudy skies. Can't even rule out a spotty passing sprinkler shower. Nothing too heavy, but the winds and the clouds just make for kind of a raw feel. Overnight temperatures slip back into the 30s. Tomorrow, more in the way of some sunshine, but highs only in the mid and upper 40s. Winds will make it feel much colder than that. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
46 degrees, 620 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
While the spotlight has been on Ukraine, there have been negotiations continuing in the Iran nuclear deal. Now, as you may have heard, Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons. This is Dmitry Sakhov. He is the Russian spokesman for President Putin. And here's what he says about the potential of Russia using nuclear weapons.
So if it is an existential threat for our country, then it can be used in accordance with our concept.
All right, so basically he's saying if it's a threat, well, you know, they can say anything they want. They'll use anything they want as justification. They use the threat, I guess, as justification for going into Ukraine. So basically they'll do whatever they want. Well, what does that mean for us in the nuke negotiations? Ned Price, State Department spokesman, tells us that there is the possibility, as there have been reports this week, there is the possibility that as part of the deal, we would allow Iran to sell uranium to the Russians. Remember, they use uranium to make nukes, right? And here's the justification.
To accept and to pay for the highly enriched uranium to get it out of Iran's hands so that Iran cannot obtain a nuclear weapon, I think that's a role we'd be willing to entertain.
All right, so we're going to send the uranium to Russia, who's threatening to use nuclear weapons, so that the Iranians don't use them to make nuclear weapons. What's wrong with that picture? What's wrong with the polls for the president? The administration and the president are just tanking. And, I mean, we could spend the whole morning going through the number of just rough poll results for the president this week in a Fox News poll. 52% of those polled say that the gas prices are a major impact on their family. 36% say a minor impact. And 12%, those with electrical vehicles, I guess, are not impacted by their electric vehicles. So that's not good news for the president when it comes to simply the gas price. There's all kinds of bad numbers. We'll get into them a little bit later on in the program with Jennifer Harper on poll numbers. But the interesting approach now is the president is talking about potentially checks to everyone to help pay for the gas. Nice idea. In an election year, why not send out a check in an election year? Well, Gavin Newsom in California is thinking about something similar, the governor.
So today we're announcing a $9 billion tax refund to tens of millions of Californians, $400 for each registered vehicle that an individual owns, up to two vehicles. That direct relief will address the issue that we all are struggling to address, and that's the issue of gas prices.
Gee whiz. Maybe if you all hadn't shut down the fossil fuel industry a year and a half ago in terms of the things you said, the threats you made about the fossil fuel industry. Maybe they would have expanded production instead of going, they're going to be cracking down on us. Now, speaking of crackdowns, we could use a crackdown on crime around the country. I've got a running tally of stories that one morning I will just read you some of these headlines. So we never have time to do it. But there was a report out of California this week, and we have some audio from the Beverly Hills police chief. Now, if you've ever been to Beverly Hills, you would think it is probably one of the safer neighborhoods in the country. Well, there have been a rash of robberies in Beverly Hills. So here's how the Beverly Hills police chief is addressing the problem. He puts it on you.
There's been a marked increase of armed robberies involving victims wearing expensive jewelry. And what we're asking the public to be mindful of is that with these increases, that if they're going to wear expensive jewelry, or as they are involved in perhaps driving high-end cars, leaving restaurants, taverns, and other locations, that they be mindful of their surrounding, that they remain in well-lit areas, and that they recognize that there are opportunists that are attempting to take advantage of them. And many times these individuals are armed with a firearm.
So if you've got a decent car or you're wearing a watch that's decent, if you're in Beverly Hills, when you come out of the restaurant, you better look around everywhere and make sure the streets aren't dark where you are or the parking garage isn't dark. In Beverly Hills, is there something wrong going on in the country? There's a story out of Denver, happened late last night that we thought we would pass along to you. There was a trial. Jurors on Friday found that police used excessive force against protesters violating their constitutional rights during demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd 2 years ago. The jury in Denver ordered the city to pay a total of $14 million in damages to a group of 12 who sued. Now, during the trial, Denver admitted that mistakes were made at the protests, which it says were unprecedented in their size, duration, and amount of violence and destruction. Over 80 officers were injured as protesters hurled rocks, water bottles, and canned food at them. The state capitol, the hub of the protests, incurred $1.1 million in damage, according to the city. But 12 protesters are going to get a check for $14 million that they will split because the Denver police used excessive force. Wouldn't you think they would have at least deducted the $1.1 million out of the $14 million so they could pay for the damage at the state capitol? 627, the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news at 6:30, President Biden speaking in Poland today. It's being billed as a major speech on NATO and the situation in Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities say about 300 people were killed in that airstrike last week that blasted open a theater in Mariupol that had been serving as a shelter for women and children. It would make it the war's deadliest known attack on civilians yet. And Russian forces this morning appear to have halted, at least for now, their ground offensive aimed at capturing the capital of Kyiv. North Korea's test of a big new intercontinental ballistic missile is prompting the U.S. to press for stiffer U.N. sanctions, but China and Russia are showing little appetite for tightening restrictions that they've been trying to have eased. And Donald Trump's luxury hotel, the Trump International on Pennsylvania Avenue near the White House, has received government approval to hand the keys to a Miami investment fund. It's a sale that many industry experts had doubted would ever go through. The federal agency overseeing the building says that an extensive and exhaustive review found no problem with the Trump Organization plans to sell to a fund led by GCI Merchant Group. Among those investors, New York Yankees slugger Alex Rodriguez, $375 million price tag, far more than many expected for a hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue that had reportedly been losing money recently. Time for a check of the traffic and weather. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the outer loop of the Beltway in Camp Springs, just after Branch Avenue, accident activity is on the left shoulder, just causing a very brief delay there. No other Beltway problems to report at this time. Everything is running at speed throughout Maryland and Virginia. You will find some street closures in place now for the Rock and Roll Half Marathon that will be taking place. Constitution Avenue currently is closed between 15th Street and 9th Street. And also expect to find other street closures in the area, including 18th Street between Constitution Avenue and E Street. And E Street will be closed between 18th Street and 19th Street. All closures until about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Definitely a cool weekend headed your way with a fair amount of cloud cover as well. Temperatures today only in the low to mid-50s with mostly cloudy skies. Can't even rule out a spotty passing sprinkler shower. Nothing too heavy. But the winds and the clouds just make for kind of a raw feel. Overnight temperatures slip back into the 30s. Tomorrow, more in the way of some sunshine, but highs only in the mid and upper 40s. Winds will make it feel much colder than that. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
46 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:33 on the Saturday Morning Update. It's the Saturday Morning Update. So glad you've joined us this weekend. And Jennifer Harper joins us every weekend, and we are so glad to have her as part of the team here. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
So the White House and Jen Psaki in the briefing room continue to tell us how great the economy is. How do the American people view that?
Oh, my gosh. It's funny you should ask. Actually, it's sort of hair-raising what the American people think right now, because there were two polls that came out this week that are truly revealing what James Carville used to say, and it's the economy, stupid. And those words, you know, he came up with that in 1992, I do believe, and those four words still apply very much today. Let's look at our polls, though. This is coming from Grinnell College, and they have found out that only 27% of Americans, that's a quarter of Americans, think that the economy is going to be better in a year, in a whole year. And this is a drop of 20 percentage points in a poll that they also conducted about a year ago. And they also found out that 58% of the respondents felt that the economy is going to get worse in the next 12 months, and 57% disapprove of the way President Biden has handled economic issues overall. And let's move on down to another poll. This is coming from our friends at Issues and Answers. They have a tip poll, always interesting. And they are saying that Americans now face personal economic disaster. That is the words that they use. That's why I put that in the Beltway. It kind of made my hair stand on end. But anyway, they asked people, how much do you have in emergency savings, like money that is really available from your checking or savings account or a money market account, something like that. And so they were given a couple of different answers, like no emergency savings, 1 month's expense, 2 months' expense, et cetera, et cetera. And so according to Terry Jones, he's the editor of Issues and Insights, he wrote that, sadly, the biggest category by far was no emergency savings. And 34% of the respondents there said they had nothing. There you go. Not a thing set aside. And 1 month and 2 months savings garnered about 11% each. And so he says, Mr. Jones says, 56% of all Americans, that's over half the population, have either no savings or barely enough to last 2 months should economic trouble occur. For most, that means they are one job loss or personal injury away from economic disaster. So that's your read on the economy this week, Rick.
But we don't have to worry, because they're going to be filling up our tanks with all that federal money, coincidentally, in an election year, by coincidence. The public seems to be able to see through a lot of the administration misinformation, but our newscasters continue to kind of give them a pass on the gas.
That's a great way to put it, Rick. That's fantastic. Yes, indeed, our newscasters, and this is the big three, ABC, CBS, and NBC, they're continuing to shield Biden, and I've got the interesting study here for you from Newsbusters, always a a great watchdog. But before we get into that study, I have to tell you, I did a little research on some of the worst prices in the United States. And currently in San Luis Obispo, California, gas is now $6.08 a gallon. So we're still in the midst of all that stuff. And, you know, if you wonder if the newscasters are blaming Biden, well, no, not at all. Again, back to our newsbusters.org. This is a conservative press watchdog and their new study. It's coming from Scott Whitlock. He's the research director over there at Newsbusters. He says Americans over the last months have been enduring painful skyrocketing gas prices. The impacts are echoing out to all parts of the economy and squeezing already stressed wallets. But if you watch the morning and evening network newscast, you would think almost all the blame for this falls on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Joe Biden, his role has almost entirely been ignored. And he actually watched the coverage of this, monitored the coverage of this subject for almost a month. And he says from February 24th to March 21st, the networks put the culpability squarely on Russia by an 11-to-1 margin. ABC, CBS, and NBC blamed Russia a whopping 33 times and the Democrat president just 3 times. The breakdown by the network, NBC blamed Russia 16 times, CBS 11 times, and ABC 6 times. And he also said that Mr. Biden has already promised to get rid of fossil fuels and coal plants and all that sort of stuff. And so Mr. Whitlock says that networks are doing everything they can to censor his crippling energy policy. So he is kind of getting a pass there.
So the former president is headed to Georgia this weekend. What's he up to?
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, former President Trump, he just loves those big rallies, and he's got a great big humongous one down there in the Peachtree State. And today he is heading down to Commerce, Georgia, for one of those big signature jumbo rallies, all the trimmings, and a couple of notable guests here. Among those who will be sharing the stage with Mr. Trump are Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Andrew Clyde, and Jody Meats. They're all Georgia Republicans. And also David Perdue, former U.S. Senator from Georgia, and he's now running for Georgia governor. State Senator Burt Jones, he's a candidate for Lieutenant Governor Georgia. And football great Herschel Walker will be there, Heisman Trophy, and he's now a candidate for the U.S. Senate. And his current campaign motto, just as a side, is run, fight, and win. But that's another story. And anyway, Tom Homan, the former acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, will be along, plus conservative columnist, radio host Todd Starnes will also be on hand. And he says, I'll be delivering remarks along with a number of other great American patriots. That's according to Todd Starnes. And according to the local newspaper, that is Banks News Today down there, 20,000 people are expected at the rally. Vendors have been there all week, and they're doing a very brisk business selling Trump memorabilia. So it kind of seems like it's all the same going on, same old, same old.
Well, he got some support from somewhere else that might have been unexpected.
Yeah, it certainly was for me, because I put it in the Beltway, and this is coming from Emerson College, and they did a poll of 1,023 registered U.S. voters conducted March 18 through 20. And, you know, President Trump does continue with his rallies, making his rivals pretty angry with all that. But he continues, as we mentioned, same old, same old. Here's what the Emerson College voter poll has to say. It was released Tuesday. It reveals that President Biden currently has a 43% approval rating. And it mentions that he's struggling very much with independent voters. Only 28% approve of the job he is doing. 64% disapprove. Uh-oh. But anyway, here's what they say about former President Trump. He has a 12-point favorability advantage over Biden.
Wow.
59% of voters say they are somewhat or very favorable of Trump, compared with only 47% who feel the same way about Biden. And in a hypothetical 2024 election, former President Trump versus Biden trails 45% to 42%. That's 3 percentage points. That's a statistical significant thing there, but it's close. But Trump's still coming coming out ahead. Again, this is an Emerson College poll.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Thank you, Jennifer. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. We're at 6:43. This is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, and we're going to head over to Michelle Murray. She's in the WMAL Traffic Center. Then we're back with Jim Trusty, and we'll take a look at the latest in the Supreme Court nomination process for Judge Jackson.
On the outer loop of the Beltway in Camp Springs, just after Branch Avenue, accident activity is on the left shoulder, just causing a very brief delay there. No other Beltway problems to report at this time. Everything is running at speed throughout Maryland and Virginia. You will find some street closures in place now for the Rock and Roll Half Marathon that will be taking place. Constitution Avenue currently is closed between 15th Street and 9th Street, and also expect to find other street closures in the area, including 18th Street between Constitution Avenue and E Street, and E Street will be closed between 18th Street and 19th Street. All closures until about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Definitely a cool weekend headed your way with a fair amount of cloud cover as well. Temperatures today only in the low to mid-50s with mostly cloudy skies. Can't even rule out a spotty passing sprinkler shower. Nothing too heavy. But the winds and the clouds just make for kind of a raw feel. Overnight temperatures slip back into the 30s. Tomorrow, more in the way of some sunshine, but highs only in the mid and upper 40s. Winds will make it feel much colder than that. I'm 7 News meteorologist Brian Vandegraaff in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
46 degrees at 6:44 on the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Jim Trusty joins us each week. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, great to have you with us again.
Thanks. Good morning.
It would appear after the Senate hearings this week that Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will be a Supreme Court justice when all is said and done in the United States Senate. You watch the hearings, and you have been a prosecutor. Your analysis at week's end.
Well, I think there's a number of things that are kind of noteworthy about the whole process. I mean, number one, really all of the recent justice applicants have been in a position where they can pretty comfortably fend off the hardest questions, where they can just basically say, you know, that's a matter that might be before the court and I can't comment on it. And that seems to be increasingly accepted. So the downside of that is we're also getting candidates in a lot of cases, and particularly this one, where there's not a big track record of their judicial philosophy. You know, this is a judge who's been on the bench for about 10 years. She has a good reputation, good pedigree in terms of education, law journal, that type of thing. But 9 of those years were on the trial court at the U.S. District Court in D.C. And although that generates some opinions, it's very different than an appellate court practice. You're focusing on much different things. And indeed, a lot of her questions were devoted to her career as a trial court, as a trial judge. So really, she only has about a year of appellate experience, and that makes it very difficult to really glean where she's going to go. I have to think that she's going to be, you know, politically liberal, and she wouldn't be picked if she wasn't going to be. But it's very difficult to really get a sense of how she'll rule on any particular issue when the experience is limited and the questions are kind of truncated. I did not think it was a great moment when she was unwilling or unable to define the word woman. That just seems like we're at a new level of wokeism that is just bizarre when a judge is afraid to give a definition of a woman when asked. But all in all, I think she, again, handled herself pretty well. She's certainly an intelligent jurist and one that is pretty popular in Washington, D.C., from what I can tell. So I think, you know, obviously you're going to have the party breakdown. There probably will be some Republicans that basically say, hey, advise and consent means that we go ahead and vote yes for an otherwise qualified candidate. And I think that's what's probably coming.
I know you were a prosecutor at the Department of Justice, so I'm sure you've had some experience in this area. Your thoughts on basically how judges handle child pornography cases?
Yeah, this really touched a nerve with me, and I think it was probably the one substantive area where some of the Republican challengers made some headway and had the judge feeling, at least appearing, a little bit defensive. The basic notion was they had dug up information from several child pornography cases where she had sentenced far below the sentencing guidelines and where she had refused to apply certain guideline enhancements, such as the fact that images included prepubescent children, and the adjustment that relates to the number of images that a person might possess or transfer. These seem like pretty commonsensical aggravators to the offense, and it was interesting that she appeared to be against those. But what struck me was, you know, when I was a federal prosecutor, and even when I was a state prosecutor handling some of these cases, they're devastating cases to deal with. It is really, I mean, I used to tell people I'd rather look at 100 autopsy pictures than one child pornography picture, because you can actually learn something that's helpful to your murder case when you're looking at an autopsy. Child pornography just really hurts the soul to even see it. But there was a very widespread tolerance by the bench that I would see, particularly in the federal court, that was really kind of extraordinary. And I don't know if it's because they get numb to certain crimes or because they felt some sort of sympathy towards these defendants, which I again, don't really understand, except that many of the defendants didn't have criminal records and were kind of sad sack stories of middle-aged men. But the market they fuel, even if they're just possessing these images, they are creating a market where victims are made every day and in the most horrific ways. And I remember distinctly one time at a sentencing forcing the judge to look at some of the images before he sentenced the defendant, because I was getting this feeling that it was just not being treated like a real crime, that it was some sort of technicality from the judge's perspective. And the judge was angry at me. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, if you're not even willing to look at these horrible images, like I have to do as a prosecutor, well, then of course you're not going to treat the cases as seriously as you should. So, again, I don't mean to go down too long a memory road here, but just to make the point that, you know, this was such a widespread phenomenon that Congress passed the PROTECT Act in the mid-2000s, which created mandatory sentences. They got tired of judges playing cute with the sentencing guidelines and finding ways to give lighter sentences for these defendants. So all of a sudden, possession, manufacturing, distribution of child pornography all had very stiff mandatory sentences associated with them. And yeah, that was a congressional reaction that I respect. I actually think it makes sense if judges are not going to treat it seriously, that it's within their realm to go ahead and force more severe outcomes for those types of cases. So it touched a lot of nerves with me to see those questions. It doesn't surprise me that a federal judge has at least some cases that are questionable when it comes to child pornography. And, you know, I welcome the public scrutiny to that issue. I think all of us should be more aware of just how devastating that market is.
Former President Trump filing a lawsuit this week against Hillary Clinton and others over the Russia stories surrounding the 2016 election. Where does this go? Does he have a chance of recouping the $24 million he is seeking?
Well, $24 million, but in RICO, civil RICO, you can get treble damages. So our number gets, you know, exponentially higher. It's a really interesting situation, and it touches a lot of third rails from a prosecutor perspective. I don't think John Durham is thrilled that this case is out there. But when you look at the 108-page complaint that was filed in Florida, it really basically gathers up all this information, some of it from just public stories, some of it from indictments from the Durham team, like the Sussman and Danchenko indictments. And it lays out an allegation that spans all of the kind of Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign camp and all of the FBI leadership camp. I mean, Comey, Strzok, Page, Bruce Ohr, I mean, Kleinsmith. I mean, literally everybody that you and I have talked about over the last couple of years when it comes to the Durham investigation makes its way into this civil RICO case. What's, I think, problematic from the president's side is a lot of these cases, they're not really loved by the bench, and that's because civil RICO is designed to be a very difficult thing to prove and difficult thing to recover under, just because it's typically based on organized crime. But in this case, you know, a lot of them get dismissed long before any discovery takes place, before the parties can gather up the information that they really want to get from the other side. Now, if it survives the motion to dismiss and goes to the discovery phase, then it gets incredibly interesting. I mean, think of Donald Trump's lawyers trying to do a deposition of Hillary Rodham Clinton, of Jim Comey, of Jake Sullivan. All of the discovery phase becomes extremely interesting to the Trump camp. But I think they're going to have some real issues on the motion to dismiss. I mean, I think it's going to be uphill. They're alleging the theft of trade secrets and obstruction of justice as the pattern of racketeering activity that you have to prove to do a civil RICO case. Those are going to be big battlegrounds. And, again, watch out for John Durham saying, I don't want this case to interfere with mine, because he could easily go to the court in Florida and seek a stay of the civil case. He probably wouldn't do it until after the motions to dismiss are decided, but he may well make sure no discovery takes place anytime soon because of the indictments that he already has, as well as possibly indictments to come.
What about the multiple counts that are filed in here, including defamation?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the main story is the RICO and RICO conspiracy, but then there's other things such as defamation, malicious prosecution, even computer crimes that are alleged. The defamation is going to be interesting because he's a public figure, so you have to show actual malice. That's usually a very difficult burden. But if you are literally able to prove the other side knowingly and intentionally planted false stories of sexual dalliances and of Russian collusion, then you're in pretty good shape in terms of the defamation burden that you have to meet. So if he can pull this evidence together in a way that I think Durham has kind of cleared the path for him to do, there are counts in this thing that could easily survive and become a real problem for folks like Hillary Rodham Clinton and Jim Comey over the next year.
And we heard the story that the New York Times finally confirmed the existence of Hunter Biden's laptop that's been so discussed and so ignored in the media. Where does that go in terms of a congressional investigation?
Well, it sounds like that's coming, and maybe it's a function of predicting what's going to happen at the midterm, because Representative Daryl Issa has notified a whole bunch of folks from big tech, from the Democratic Party, from the administration, that they need to hold on to any records, to do a records preservation request, any records they have that relate to Hunter Biden's laptop. And again, the prosecutor in me, which was, you know, the bulk of my career as a lawyer, cringes at the thought of the politicians getting out in front of criminal cases. You know, I'd like to see the Delaware U.S. Attorney's Office come clean with wherever they're going to go with Hunter Biden and tell us whether there's going to be serious federal charges or if it's going to somehow fizzle out short of that. But it's an interesting shot across the bow to have all of these people put on notice that Congress is going to be looking at them very soon for what they can tell us about the Hunter Biden laptop. It's really kind of astounding that the New York Times gets any credit for suppressing a story for a year and a half and then grudgingly saying, oh, by the way, that was a real story that we hid during the election. I continue to think this is, you know, the most extraordinary possible corruption case touching the president that we'll see in our lifetime. I mean, if any of this stuff that seems to be coming out from colluding with Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, China, if any of this kind of shakedown, pay-for-play stuff has some truth to it, it's a devastating story for public corruption and the Biden family. We don't know yet, but the folks at the New York Times certainly took their sweet time acknowledging the obvious that this laptop could be a huge piece of evidence.
Well, would the prosecutor in Delaware necessarily look at all of that, or would he be focused more on maybe a tax violation of Hunter Biden if there were some issues with how money was handled?
Well, remember, the only person that's mentioned a tax case were Hunter Biden's lawyers. They came out with a comment that I felt was a trial balloon months ago that said, well, Hunter might have some tax issues to resolve. And, you know, it's kind of like, forgive the parallel, but, you know, that Al Capone might have some tax issues. I mean, you are hoping as a defense attorney that that's all you're going to have to deal with. But there are other federal statutes that are much more serious, money laundering, Foreign Agent Registration Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, much more weighty offenses that are out there that are in play. And the crazy thing is, you know, Rick, once you possess something, if law enforcement possesses the computer, most likely they do a very targeted kind of search through the computer. There's more and more regulation in this area where they have to be very careful what they look for to protect privacy rights. But if they bump into things, a kind of a plain view doctrine that you think of with police activity when they, you know, happen to see something in the back seat of the car that they stop for speeding, same concept can apply to things like computers. And so there could be other things. There's certainly rumors of other things being on the computers that could bring completely independent federal offenses. And if law enforcement or the repairman said, go look for these items, I sure saw them, there's a real liability there for Hunter. It could go, you know, into much more serious charges than just a tax offense.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you too. 6:58, Saturday morning update. News next at 7, then we've got John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkison, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland all coming up.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.